and my grandfather's failures would all become object lessons for me, and that my own children would have a father they could count on. In the most basic sense, I've succeeded. My marriage is intact, and my family is provided for. I attend parent-teacher conferences and dance recitals, and my daughters bask in my adoration. And yet, of all the areas of my life, it is in my capacities as a husband and father that I entertain the most doubt. I realize I'm not alone in this. At some level, I'm just going through the same conflicting emotions that other fathers experience as they navigate a changing economy and changing social norms. But if the gap between the idea of parenthood in my head and the compromised reality that I live isn't unique, I feel myself culpable in a way that other fathers are not. After all, I'm not in the position of those fathers who must take on two jobs or the night shift in a valiant attempt to put food on the table. I could find a job that had me home every night, or I could find a job that paid more money, a job in which long hours might at least be justified by some measurable benefit to my family, the ability of Michelle to cut back on her hours, say, or a fat trust fund for the kids. Instead, I have chosen a life with a ridiculous schedule, a life that requires me to be gone from Michelle and the girls for long stretches of time, and that exposes Michelle to all sorts of stress. I may tell myself that in some larger sense I'm in politics for Malia and Sasha, that the work I do will in some way make the world a better place for them. But such rationalizations seem feeble and painfully abstract when I'm missing one of the girls' school potlucks because of a vote, or calling Michelle to tell her that session's been extended, and we need to postpone our vacation. Indeed, my recent success in politics does little to assuage the guilt. As Michelle told me once, only half-joking, seeing your dad's picture in the paper may be kind of neat the first time it happens, but when it happens all the time, it's probably kind of embarrassing. And so I do my best to answer the accusation that floats around in my mind, that I am selfish, that I do what I do to feed my own ego or fill a void in my heart. When I'm not out of town, I try to be home for dinner, to hear from Malia and Sasha about their day, to read to them and tuck them into bed. I try not to schedule appearances on Sundays, and in the summers I'll use the day to take the girls to the zoo or the pool. In the winters we might visit a museum or the aquarium. I scold my daughters gently when they misbehave, and try to limit their intake of both television and junk food. In all of this, I'm encouraged by Michelle, although there are times when I get the sense that I'm encroaching on her space, that by my absence I may have forfeited certain rights to interfere in the world she has built. It is left to Michelle to coordinate all the children's activities, which she does with a general's efficiency. When I can, I volunteer to help, which Michelle appreciates, although she is careful to limit my responsibilities. The day before Sasha's birthday party this past June, I was told to procure 20 balloons, enough cheese pizzas to feed 20 kids, and ice. This seemed manageable, so when Michelle told me she was going to get goodie bags to hand out at the end of the party, I suggested that I do that as well. She laughed. "You can't handle goodie bags," she said. "Let me explain the goodie bag thing. You have to go into the party store and choose the bags. Then you have to choose what to put in the bags. And what are in the boys' bags have to be different from what are in the girls' bags. You'd walk in there and wander around the aisles for an hour, and then your head would explode." Feeling less confident, I got on the internet. I found a place that sold balloons near the gymnastics studio where the party would be held, and a pizza place that promised delivery at 3:45 p.m. By the time the guests showed up the next day, the balloons were in place and the juice boxes on ice. I sat with the other parents, catching up, and watching 25-year-olds run and jump and bounce on the equipment like a band of merry elves. I had a slight scare when at 3:50, the pizzas had not yet arrived, but the delivery person got there 10 minutes before the time the children were scheduled to eat. Michelle's brother Craig, knowing the pressure I was under, gave me a high five. Michelle looked up from putting pizzas on the paper plates and smiled. As a grand finale, after all the pizza was eaten and the juice boxes drank, after we had sung happy birthday and eaten some cake, the gymnastics instructor gathered all the kids around an old multicolored parachute and told Sasha to sit at its center. On the count of three, Sasha was hoisted up into the air and back down again, then up for a second time, and then for a third. and each time she rose above the billowing sail, she laughed and laughed with a look of pure joy. I wonder if Sasha will remember that moment when she has grown. Probably not. It seems as if I can retrieve only the barest fragments of memory from when I was 5. But I suspect that the happiness she felt on that parachute registers permanently in her, that such moments accumulate, embed themselves in a child's character, becoming a part of their soul. Is there a better legacy than that? Sometimes, when I listen to Michelle talk about her father, I hear the echo of such joy in her, a love and respect that Fraser Robinson earned not through fame or spectacular deeds, but through small, daily, ordinary acts, a love he earned by being there. And I ask myself whether my daughters will be able to speak of me in that same way. As it is, the window for such memories rapidly closes. Already, Malia seems to be moving into a different phase. She's more curious about boys and relationships, more self-conscious about what she wears. She's always been older than her years, uncannily wise. Once, when she was just 6 years old, and we were taking a walk together along the lake, she asked me out of the blue if our family was rich. I told her that we weren't really rich, but that we had a lot more than most people. I asked her why she wanted to know. Well, I've been thinking about it, and I've decided I don't want to be really, really rich. I think I want a simple life. Her words were so unexpected that I laughed. She looked up at me and smiled, but her eyes told me she'd meant what she'd said. I often think about that conversation. I ask myself what Malia makes of my not-so-simple life. Certainly she notices that other fathers attend her team's soccer games more often than I do. If this upsets her, she doesn't let it show, for Malia tends to be protective of other people's feelings, trying to see the best in every situation. Still, it gives me small comfort to think that my 8-year-old daughter loves me enough to overlook my shortcomings. I was able to get to one of Malia's games recently, when session ended early for the week. It was a fine summer afternoon, and the several fields were full of families when I arrived. I spotted Michelle and sat down on the grass beside her, and Sasha came to sit in my lap. At halftime, Malia came over to where we were sitting. "How you feeling, sport?" I asked her. "Great." She took a swig of water. "Daddy, I have a question."
"Shoot."
"Can we get a dog?"
"What does your mother say?"
"She told me to ask you. I think she's weakening." I looked at Michelle, who smiled and offered to shrug.
"How about we talk it over after the game?" I said.
"Okay." Malia took another sip of water and kissed me on the cheek.
"I'm glad you're home," she said to me.
Before I could answer, she had turned around and started back out onto the field. And for an instant, in the glow of the late afternoon, I thought I saw my older daughter as the woman she would become, as if with each step she were growing taller, her shape filling out, her long legs carrying her into a life of her own. I squeezed Sasha a little tighter in my lap. Perhaps sensing what I was feeling, Michelle took my hand. And I remembered a quote Michelle had given to a reporter during the campaign, when he'd asked her what it was like being a political wife. "It's hard," Michelle had said. Then, according to the reporter, she had added with a sly smile, "And that is why Barack is such a grateful man." As usual, my wife is right.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Audacity of Hope, Thoughts on Reclaiming the American Dream by Barack Obama. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Jacob Bronstein. Text copyright 2006 by Barack Obama. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.